Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silkenet, and I'm joined, as always, by Frank Cogliano. How are you doing, Speak Frank?
David, I'm great.
You're great?
Well, I'm grading essays, David. It's the end of term, so I'm a little punch drunk, so
okay.
I welcome this respite. Although, students, if you're listening, I love your essays.
Our students write very good essays on the whole.
They do. I wasn't being sarcastic.
Okay. I can never tell with you, Frank, because your sarcasm has like levels, and sometimes you're sarcastic about your sarcasm, so it builds upon itself.
I'm deeply ironic, David.
I appreciate
it. Anyway, I'm doing great. Thank you.
Good. All right. So earlier this week, on Wednesday, I believe, President Trump announced that the United States would be moving the embassy in Israel from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. This is in line with campaign promises that he made before the election. And the United States, I think, will be the first country to have a embassy in Jerusalem. I think everybody else has their embassies in a line in Tel Aviv. And so we thought this would be a good time to talk about diplomacy and about recognition and what recognition means and the ways in which you know, some of this is symbolic and some of this actually has real consequences to it.
Yeah, there's another story this week that kind of brought this to mind as well, which is the ongoing Brexit negotiations. Mm. And it's Friday morning when we're recording this, and there seems to have been a breakthrough this morning. But
I'm not optimistic about breakthroughs.
Nor am I. But there was allegedly a deal in the works on Monday, and that fell apart over the question of the border between and what the status of the border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland would be. So, kind of questions of diplomacy and recognition on our minds this week.
All right. So, I mean, I guess thinking about this in terms of American history, one of the first things the United States had to do was being recognized as the United States, Frank. So how did the Continental Congress, before it was the United States, you know, go about trying to get recognition as being a real thing?
Yeah, I mean, this is a really important question, David. And in fact, as we were thinking about this topic and chatting offline, one of the ways I think we can conceive of this subject generally before we get to the Declaration of Independence is, the Revolution is, there's a kind of arc in the 18th century, in the era of the American Revolution, the United States, the new United States, is a marginal country, both literally and figuratively. Mm-hmm. It's on the margin of the European world and the Atlantic world, which is the state system that determined international relations in that period. And it's marginal because it's weak and relatively insignificant at the time. And it's struggling for recognition. In the 19th century, and we'll get to this in a minute, there's a kind of, we see the United States emerge as a medium-sized power and its role in the world becomes more complicated. And of course, in the 20th century, it's a superpower, at least in the latter. It's a great power in the early 20th century, a superpower after 1945. And its role as a recognizer of different states becomes important. So there's a kind of, but it all starts, to answer your question, with this desire for recognition. The Declaration of Independence, which of course is the foundational, you know, it's the mission statement of the United States. It's the creed. It's the articulation of the American creed and usually remembered as such. We sometimes forget it's also a diplomatic document. It was a kind of hello world, we're here statement. Yeah. And it was a plea for recognition and diplomatic recognition. And in the context of the War of Independence, that was necessary because the United States needed the support of outside powers.
Yeah.
But it also needed the recognition of outside powers in order to achieve its independence. You can't be independent if people don't recognize you as so. Catalonia's experiencing this now.
And not only countries are, you know, secret independent recognition, but, you know, rivals for the monarchy always, you know, seek recognition. You know, you can think about all the Jacobite.
That's right. And you get pretenders claiming thrones. Yeah, that's another good example.
Often France or often Rome or, you know, somewhere claiming to be the king of Britain or king of Scotland or king of something or other, you know, and are recognized by the, you know, their court of 25 people, and that's about it.
That's right. And so if the patriots in the American War of Independence had lost the war, then the United States never would have been recognized. And so this recognition is actually essential. So Elijah Gould at the University of New Hampshire, for example, has written about this and argued quite persuasively, in my view, that the Declaration of Independence was really about the United States achieving recognition and being accepted into the community of nations. Mm. And that process begins in 1776 with the Declaration, which will eventually lead to the intervention of France into the American War of Independence in 1778, when France formally recognized the United States. The Dutch had recognized it slightly earlier. But American independence doesn't become reality, and it doesn't become a member of the international... The United States doesn't become a member of the international state system until 1783, when Britain, as the former colonial power, accepts that independence. And so there's a kind of...
transitionary phase there.
Right, from 1776 to 1783, where at some level the American Revolution has nothing to do with Republican government or equality, or resisting freedom, resisting tyranny, rather. It's depends on your perspective on this. Resisting tyranny, or the kind of tropes that people associate with it, so much as it's about international recognition.
To be sure.
And so when Donald Trump, in his own rather Trumpian way, blundered into Middle East diplomacy this week with the recognition of Jerusalem as the capital of Israel... he was, you know, participating in a long tradition, frankly, of states encountering difficult questions of recognition. I mean, this comes up in your period, David, all the time, doesn't it? I mean, it's a crucial dimension.
Well, even before that, there's a really interesting one early in American history where they have to deal with the question of are they going to recognize Haiti?
Right. That's right.
As a new country, and you know, where you know Haiti is a French colony, you know, that was built upon slave labor, and when that gets overthrown in the Haitian Revolution, you know, I guess it's your man Thomas Jefferson has to ascertain: are we going to recognize this new black republic as being part of the club of countries?
And he doesn't want to do so
for obvious, you know.
Well, the obvious reason, we should say, not necessarily obvious to our listeners, you know, for Thomas Jefferson as a Southern slaveholder. Mm. And his supporters, who weren't exclusively Southern slaveholders, but a lot of them were, you know, the prospect of recognizing a republic created by formerly enslaved people who'd overthrown their masters is not a precedent they want to set. And it's interesting because that debate over Haiti and what to do about the Haitian Republic has real echoes with what will happen later in American history, especially in the 20th century, also in the Caribbean. Mm. And so for a long time, the United States, of course, refused to recognize Cuba, which was also a revolutionary state in the Caribbean. And I think this goes to, and indeed didn't recognize it and start to normalize relations until the Obama administration. Mm. This goes to the fact that although international law is meant to be equal for all, as in so many other ways, the legal system isn't entirely equal.
Mm.
So American diplomacy for a long time in the history of the Republic was always oriented towards Europe and seeking recognition from European powers, but also engaging in the diplomatic concerns of European powers. And its attitude within its own hemisphere or the non-European world has always been a little bit different. And truth be told, in the era of 19th century imperialism, this was true for most of the European powers.
Sure.
Right. So diplomatic recognition in the 18th and 19th centuries was really something for Europeans to extend to others. Mm. The Americans blunder into this as a revolutionary state and sort of force recognition.
Yeah.
But they themselves kind of reflect and represent one can call it almost a European reluctance to encourage and recognize revolutions and new states that are created as a result of revolutions, especially in the non-European world.
Yeah. I mean, the big example from my century, of course, has to do with the United States' position on the new Confederacy in 1860 and 1861, because one of the, you know, central precepts of the Lincoln administration is that the Confederacy doesn't exist as a diplomatic reality. Now, obviously, in a sort of realpolitik on the ground, the Confederacy exists because they're, you know, in power in the South. But the Lincoln administration, from its very beginning, says secession is unconstitutional, and therefore the Confederacy itself doesn't exist. And they, you know, there's rebellion in states, but the states themselves are still within the Union. And they're doing this in large part not only because it helps to justify the war effort, but also because of the place that recognition then gives, what the rights recognition then gives to the Confederacy on the global stage. And one of the concerted efforts that the Lincoln administration makes on this side of the Atlantic is trying to stop European powers, in particular Great Britain, from recognizing the Confederacy as the legitimate power. And conversely, the Confederacy is doing everything it can to get Britain to recognize it, because that will give it legitimacy and give it access to all kinds of things that it wants.
So the shoe's really on the other foot by comparison with the American Revolution. So now the Confederacy's in the state, is in the place of the revolutionary state seeking outside recognition.
And it knows that. I mean, the Confederacy is modeling itself, saying we are doing just like our ancestors did. We are trying to get foreign powers to recognize it, just like France helped us helped us, meaning, you know, the United States in the Revolution. The Confederacy is hoping that Britain or somebody will intervene on their behalf in their war of independence.
So the paradox is that the Union finds itself in the place of Britain in analogy.
Yes.
Lincoln is George III.
Third. Okay, if we're making the analogy, yes, I guess that would be right. Or, yes.
Well, ponder that this afternoon.
Okay. Lincoln as George III. Okay, well, this complicates in some ways lots of the things that the Lincoln administration is doing, whether that's how they orchestrate the blockade, because blockade has certain meanings in international law in the 19th century. And so
you can only impose a blockade on another state.
And a blockade, and so if they're not, can you blockade your own ports? Which is what Lincoln's administration position they're doing. You know, what's the relationship with Confederate ships? They're in international waters. What's the relationship with Confederate citizens, in as much as Confederate citizens exist, how do you treat them? How do you deal with Confederate agents that are on foreign soil and all these other kinds of things?
Yeah, I mean, David, I have a question for you, because in the Revolution, certainly, international recognition meant was very, very significant when it came to prisoners of war.
Mm.
So, for example, captives who were recognized as prisoners of war were accorded certain food, for example, certain rations, and treated in a particular way. But, of course, the only people who could be accepted as prisoners of war were those recognized as combatants of another state. So, early in the conflict, Americans who were fighting for independence who were captured by the British were treated as rebels.
Yes.
And rebels can be the restrictions basically the abuse you can subject rebels to is far greater than prisoners of war.
Mm.
And this distinction was quite important. Do we see that in the Civil War?
Well, so not exactly in those terms. What you do see is a debate going on in 1861 when you're starting to have people being captured after Bull Run and what have you. Can you exchange prisoners?
Right.
They treat captive soldiers, at least early in the war, moderately well, relatively speaking. But the debate is, if we exchange prisoners, what does that mean? Does that legitimize the enemy by doing that? And Lincoln himself is pretty averse initially to exchanging prisoners, because of what that might imply about the Confederacy as a legitimate state. In 1862, they realize that actually exchanging prisoners is a really good idea for morale and for the home front and for other kinds of reasons. So they start exchanging prisoners, and they have a cartel, the Dix Hill Cartel, that arranges for that kind of prisoner exchange that lasts for most of 1862 into 1863. When it falls apart because the Confederacy doesn't recognize black soldiers as legitimate soldiers.
So this goes, and we'll get to this when we get to the 20th century, of course, and beyond. Even if you don't recognize a state, you still have to have relations with it.
Yeah. So there's this early phase where they're of the war where they're dealing with this question about we can't recognize the Confederacy, but facts on the ground mean that after battles, generals from opposing sides sometimes get together and they talk under flag of truce to deal with how you bury dead bodies and how you exchange prisoners. and doing that on a sort of local level on the ground. But the governments themselves never have any relationship with one another. You know, the Lincoln administration throughout the war says the Confederacy doesn't exist as a legal entity. And if you notice, when the war ends, the Confederacy never surrenders. Confederate armies surrender.
Right.
You know, and Jefferson Davis gets captured. But, you know, there's not the sense that which the government itself is falling, because the government, at least in the Lincoln administration's constitutional vision, doesn't exist.
So, in the three cases we've discussed thus far, what we see is in the American War of Independence and in the American Civil War, both of those, in terms of international law and this question of recognition, can be seen as civil wars.
Yes.
You know, wars within states or empires. And in one, in the case of the Revolution, the rebels win their independence, and that that independence is recognized and sanctified in law, and the United States is admitted to the international community. In the case of the Civil War, the rebels lose. They do not achieve recognition. In the case of Haiti, it's not a civil war involving the United States. There was a civil war in Haiti in the sense that there was a slave rebellion. But we see the United States as a third party, if you will, being called upon to recognize that state and declining to do so for a long time. So I guess what we see in this in these three cases is kind of different, if you will, different motivations at work or different circumstances. And if you know, we started this with thinking about President Trump's recognition of Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. That's more like the Haitian case, in that it's how the United States is engaging with a third party.
I mean, I think that makes sense. I mean, one of the things that's different, though, in the 20th century from these earlier examples is, you know, when we talk about international law and international community in the 18th and 19th century, it's a pretty abstract concept. International law as a body, you know, exists philosophically, but doesn't actually exist in practice. Or at least not an enforceable practice in the 18th and 19th century. It's not really until you get in the 20th century that you have international law with actual teeth to it, or something resembling teeth to it, and international bodies like the League of Nations and the United Nations, where you actually have people who are members, and you can say these people are either in the club or they're out of the club. Whereas in the 19th century, you can have these weird, you know, sort of gray areas in which people are, you know, like the British government, for instance, you know, sort of recognizes the Confederacy, never officially recognizes the Confederacy, but they wink and nod in interesting ways to the Confederacy. In the 20th century, there are much more clear delineations about what membership in you know, the community of nations means.
Yeah, I mean, there's one that we've neglected, though, from the 19th century before we move on, which is Texas, of course.
Oh, sure.
So Texas rebels and ostensibly wins its independence from Mexico in 1836. The Texas Republic is recognized internationally by Britain and France, which have diplomatic relations with it. Not, of course, by Mexico.
Right.
So it's in this liminal state for a decade.
Texas, I mean, it was an interesting case in as much as, you know, what the white Texans really wanted was to be annexed by the United States, you know, and there's complicated reasons why the United States, why Congress didn't move on that, but it does have this sort of liminal status for a decade, where it's, you know, an independent nation that doesn't really want to be an independent nation.
Right. It wants to vote itself out of existence.
And you know exactly where its borders are. We're in huge amounts of dispute. Thinking about in the 20th century, you know, once we get this actual international system in place and recognition matters, what other countries, Frank, do you think are the really pivotal ones in terms of this kinds of symbolic diplomacy of who we consider real actors and who we consider?
Well, it always comes down to revolution, it seems to me. And this is ironic because as we began this podcast, the United States is born of a revolution. Enshrined in its founding document, the Declaration of Independence is a right of revolution.
Sure.
Yet, as the United States becomes a great power and then laterally a superpower, it becomes very, very reluctant to extend recognition to other revolution, to revolutionary states, I should say, rather than other revolutionary states. Now, this is always the way of great powers. Great powers are always reluctant to admit new members to the club, as it were. And so, you know, the Russian Revolution, we're just kind of, we've just marked the centenary of the Russian Revolution, the outbreak of the Russian Revolution in 1917. The United States doesn't recognize the Soviet Union until 1933, I believe. Latterly in China, the United States, you know, does not recognize the independence or does not recognize communist China for decades.
Yes, yeah, so, well, I mean, for a while, for a long time, the United States recognized Taiwan as being China.
Yes,
you know, which was this enormous fiction where we claimed that the Taiwanese government was the government for all of China, just the way that China claims it's the government for all of China, including Taiwan. But you know, that recognition didn't. It wasn't until the 1970s, you know, with starting with Nixon, with ping pong diplomacy, and the visit to China in 72. But then I think officially it was 79 under Carter that the we opened an embassy, you know, in China and recognized that, you know, the one China policy that the United States understood that the People's Republic of China was China, but at the same time we sort of kept recognition, something shorter of official recognition, but a kind of de facto relationship with the Republic of China, that is Taiwan. You know, so we have economic relationships with Taiwan and trade negotiations and those kinds of things, but that are predicated upon Taiwan not declaring its independence from the rest of China and other kinds of things. So we have this weird fiction that we're maintaining in the relationship with China that Trump almost messed up, if you remember, from right after
his,
you know, where he took a phone call from the leader of Taiwan and you know, seemed to suggest the United States was leaving the one China policy. You know,
that's right. Well, fiction's an interesting word in this context, David, because to some extent this whole question of recognition is incredibly significant, but it's also a fiction. So, I mean, you asked what countries that this has been significant for the United States in the 20th century. Cuba, already mentioned, is a very important case. You know, after the Cuban Revolution in 1959, the United States refused to recognize Castro's Cuba.
Yeah, I think they severed ties in 61 officially.
Right, yeah. That's right. And then didn't officially reestablish those ties until a few years ago.
Yeah. And even I think now we still don't have an embassy in...
Well, they closed the embassy, didn't they?
Yeah, but I think, you know, I think that requires congressional approval in order to sort of formalize relationships with Cuba. And I think Trump has taken a step back from Obama. You know, Obama made a visit to Cuba right before
that's
he
right,
left office.
That's right. Well, there's certainly an American diplomatic presence, which is now, again, been scaled back under Obama, in the aftermath of Obama's normalization policy. But with regard to this question of recognition, and I'm again using air quotes for our viewers, you wait till we get a TV program, David. My air quotes are going to be key to it. The question of recognition is a funny one because, on one hand, it is important, a great power like the United States deciding to recognize a country, you know, has diplomatic ramifications and has ramifications for international relations that are quite significant. On the other hand, this whole thing is a little bit of a fiction is the word you used, and that's true, I think. So if one considers two countries the United States doesn't have diplomatic relations with, North Korea and Iran, which are pretty close to the top of the list of the countries the United States is most likely to wage war in the foreseeable future. You'd say, well, it's crazy they don't have relations with them because you have to talk to your enemies. And indeed, that's true. And so because of the fiction of non-recognition, what happens is states continue to talk to each other, but they use third parties. So for years and years and years... I think it was the Canadians looked after American interests in Cuba.
Or the Swiss.
Or the Swiss and the Swedes. You basically go to well-meaning neutrals who are kind of your allies to do this kind of thing. And it's what must be a hassle for the Canadians and the Swiss and the Swedes, for one thing. But it's also a bit of a nonsense at the same time. So you think, well, if the United States recognized Iran and had a full kind of ambassadorial and diplomatic presence in Tehran, then...
Because right now in Tehran, they've got a guy in the Swiss embassy who is like the representing U.S. interests, and he's got like a desk and an office.
Right.
It's like, well, that's, you know, it's weird. It's a sort of a weird fiction that you say, well, this person is not a representing the United States. They're representing, you know, Switzerland.
And given Iran's importance, let's take the Iranian example. Mm. Given Iran's importance as a regional power, its influence in both Afghanistan, Iraq, both Afghanistan and Iraq, and also Syria to some extent. You know, it's crazy, the United States and the importance of the nuclear agreement with Iran. You'd think that these are countries the United States must have relations with, but relations connotes approval.
Yes,
and
legitimate. You know, we don't. The United States doesn't recognize, you know, ISIS.
Right,
and ISIS claims to be a state.
Right, right. And however, the Iranian state, arising again from a revolution in 1979, has existed now for going on 40 years. It's a nonsense not to accept its existence and to recognize. It seems to me.
Yeah. Well, and you notice one of the ways in which, you know, the Iranian case is interesting because one of the ways in which, you know, the revolution manifested its animosity towards the United States was by attacking the embassy.
Yes.
You know, and you know, I think most people sort of know the Iranian sort of hostage story with the embassy. My tangential connection to that, the United States seized the Iranian embassy in D.C. after that in a peaceful way, not in a sort of violent, you know, student-led rebellion kind of way. They auctioned off all the property in the Iranian embassy in D.C. My parents bought a table. So I had a table in my house growing up from the Iranian embassy.
Okay. This is news to me, listeners. So first of all, was it a nice table?
It was a very nice. What's it from? It's from an embassy,
right? Okay, but how did they acquire it? How did one participate in this auction?
They had a public auction in D.C. in 1980. My parents moved to D.C. in 1980, and they were furnishing a house.
So it wasn't like a yard sale. Outside the embassy and say, you know.
No, they had a public auction, and they bought a sort of a side table, and it's got on the bottom stamp, like property of the government of Iran.
So is there a danger that David, actually, listener, I think you need to consider that David is a biased person in this discussion, because of course you don't want Iran to be recognized, because that table could be repatriated if it is.
Oh, I don't. My relationship with my parents right now is so complicated. I don't really give a damn about the table.
Right. That's fascinating.
I don't know what the other pieces of the Iranian embassy, where those have been dispersed to, but they're probably in houses all over the greater D.C. area right now, silverware and other kinds of things. You know.
So if in the future, there's a harmonious relationship between Iran
and they all want all this stuff back.
And they want to recreate the embassy as it was in 1981 or whatever.
Yeah.
This will be very, very difficult for museum curators to reacquire all this material.
Yes, I imagine that there will be higher priorities and more.
So,
difficult.
Did you eat off this table?
No, it was like an end table. So right. I mean, it wasn't like a dining room table. It was sort of a, you know, thing you put a lamp on.
Right. Okay. So did you use it for anything apart from...
No, I think it was probably in sort of the part of the living room that was not for children. Yeah, that's my connection to the Iranian Revolution.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of David Silkenet and his furniture. So...
I know, growing up, I didn't know it was the Iranian table. Right. It was just like a table in the room. Like my parents then showed it to me. It's like, oh, look at that. Okay, I'm just going to stand. But, you know, I think you're right that the sort of fiction, going back to the sort of bigger point about Iran, is, you know, it's been nearly 40 years since the Iranian Revolution. The fact that the United States doesn't have formal relationships complicates, you know, international diplomacy, you know, figuring out how do you talk to countries like North Korea that don't have diplomatic relationships with pretty much anybody. How do you negotiate when you don't have that established relationship? How do you broker those kinds of deals? You know, in some places like Cuba, it's moderately easy because lots of people have relationships with Cuba.
Right, that's right.
North Korea is more difficult because, you know, other than I think China, there's not a whole lot of countries that have robust relationships with North Korea that are willing, you know, can talk with them on equal footing.
Yeah, I mean, I was recently reading William Shirer's diary, the journalist and kind of popular historian of the early 20th century, and Shirer was a journalist in Berlin when the Second World War broke out. And his account is very, very interesting on a number of levels, because as the lights go out in Europe, as the war spreads, the diplomats begin to leave. And he says, well, you know, I went, you know, he's had drinks with the British ambassador, but they're leaving tomorrow. But there was a kind of formality to it, even in the Second World War, and even with a regime like the Nazis, who respected that, you know, so diplomats were given safe passage to leave, but also that diplomatic presence remains until the very outbreak of the conflict. Exactly. And so when, you know, Shirer goes to Paris after the German occupation, he visits the American embassy, because, of course, there's an open and functioning American embassy in Paris, even under the Nazi occupation, because at that point, the Germany and the United States weren't at war.
Yeah.
And so, and it's interesting how important that was, and that diplomatic presence was. And without, when you don't recognize countries, you miss out on that.
Well, when you think about the Cuba Missile Crisis, you know, the fact that the Soviet Union had an embassy in the United States and could have, you know, direct contact between Soviet, you know, ambassadors and, you know, the U.S. government during the Cuba Missile Crisis probably prevented World War III from breaking out. You can imagine a situation in which those kinds of, you know, formal and informal negotiations weren't taking place. Things could have gone desperately wrong then.
In thinking about the... So we've provided some historic context to this question of recognition. Now, of course, the United States has recognized Israel since...
Well, the United States was the first country to recognize Israel.
So this movement of the embassy on one hand seems to be symbolic. However, one of the things we've learned about President Trump is that he does see himself as a bit of an iconoclast. And he seems to have been motivated to announce his recognition of Jerusalem as the capital of Israel to satisfy his base, to demonstrate that he's different from his predecessors, all of whom refused to do so. Or notionally did so, but never moved the embassy there. So,
or that they said they would move the embassy if peace negotiations progressed to the point where it was conducive to
Right. So, but President Trump, in recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, seems to be making a quite powerful statement about his government's policy, even if that wasn't his intent.
Yes.
So I think there's an issue there, but it's underscored the fact that, at least to me, that we've had recent reports that, and we've been hearing this since January, it must be said, that about the number of positions in the State Department that have gone unfilled, and the number of ambassadorships that have gone unfilled.
Like the ambassador to South Korea.
Right.
You would think that would matter. But.
You would think it would matter. And the fact that there have been cutbacks in the State Department budget. And so, to some extent, we're talking about recognition at the at the very moment when the diplomatic kind of weight of the United States and the diplomatic footprint of the United States is shrinking.
Yeah, no, I think so, there's a hollowing out of the State Department.
That's a good way to put it.
And, you know, Trump has been publicly derisive of his own Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson. He challenged him to an IQ test at one point, which, you know... When Thomas Jefferson was Secretary of State, did he, you know, you can't imagine any other sort of relationship.
I don't recall. Now, I have to check the record, but I don't recall George Washington challenging to an IQ test.
Maybe a horse race, but like not a, you know, maybe who's better at the fiddle or something. I don't. Yeah, but
so we're at a moment of. Diplomatic confusion, it seems to me. And on the other hand, Trump places a great deal of significance and importance. He invests a great deal of significance and importance in these kind of symbolic gestures.
Yeah.
So symbolic diplomacy and these questions of recognition probably mean more to him than some of his predecessors.
But I'm not sure, you know, this isn't going to surprise any of our listeners. I'm not sure he understands what these symbols actually mean. I think he understands it's important to certain members of his base to move the embassy to Jerusalem. It seems to be very important to the sort of the evangelical Christian right wing, you know, part of his base. It seems to be very important to the Israeli lobby that the embassy be moved. But I'm not sure he understands on a sort of global scale what the significance of it is and why people would be upset about it.
No, and he had no one to tell him that, really. Although, apparently, people did try to tell him.
I don't know whether you get these emails from the State Department every time there's a warning to U.S. citizens abroad that we may be targeted because of something the government does. I've gotten two of those in the past 2 days, in large part as a consequence of, actually just entirely because of this announcement that they're going to move the embassy. So somebody in the State Department's paying attention, but it's not somebody who has the ear of the president, perchance. You know, and one can imagine similar kinds of things popping up, in Spain right now, where there's an independence, recognition there is going to matter a huge amount. One can imagine here in Scotland that if there's another referendum or what have you, how the Trump administration is going to deal with these questions.
Well, there was a great deal of blowback, you may recall, locally during the referendum here in 2014 when President Obama appeared to give an opinion when he said, basically, it's for the people of Scotland to decide, but we wouldn't want to see the United Kingdom broken up. It wasn't seeming to take a side. He did take a side.
Yeah.
And that alone caused a great deal of storm and drama here.
Yes.
One can imagine, Trump's got a problematic relationship with Scotland anyway, but some sort of intervention in that debate from President Trump would be probably much more amplified and much more unwelcome than even President Obama's.
All right. I guess time for our last drops. Frank, what do you got?
Well, David, I've got a couple things. Hamilton is about to open in London, so it's getting a great deal of attention here. I know you're going in a few weeks'
time. Yes, I'm very excited about that. I got tickets on the day it opened.
Excellent. You'll enjoy it very much, I'm sure. I saw it in New York about 18 months ago, and it's fabulous. I mean, it really does live up to the hype. But I'll be interested to see how British audiences respond to it and whether they respond differently from American audiences. Not because because it is about the American Revolution. It's not anti-British in any way. In fact, the character of George III is incredibly sympathetic and very funny and amusing. But I wonder whether the audience will kind of get it because they just won't be as familiar with the story and the characters, if you will, the figures in the show. I think it'll be okay because I think it's had a kind of global reach already and it's permeated the kind of culture in significant ways. And you don't have to be an expert on the French Revolution to enjoy Les Mis.
Exactly.
So I think it'll be okay, but I'll be interested to see how that plays out. But I've got a second one. I want to extend congratulations to my friend and colleague Doug Bradburn at Mount Vernon. Doug is a fine scholar of early American history, particularly the politics of the early republic. And for the past several years, Doug has been the director of the National Library for George Washington at Mount Vernon, which is Washington's home and its museum. And it was announced a couple of days ago that Doug is now the 11th president of Mount Vernon. So he's the president. He's the president of the president's home.
Okay.
So Doug will be responsible for, he's the president and CEO of Mount Vernon, which is George Washington's home, and it's a major museum in the United States, it's a kind of locus of public history. You get over a million visitors a year.
All right.
It's well worth a visit if you haven't visited it, but congratulations to Doug Bradburn.
Congratulations to Doug on that, that's
and
great.
I'm really pleased they put a scholar in that role.
Yeah, yes.
That's great. What about you, David? What's your
last one? So I was very disturbed earlier this week. I think, like lots of people were, to hear that President Trump is shrinking two national monuments, Bears Ears and Grand Staircase Escalante. And I've not been to Bears Ears, but Grand Staircase Escalante is a really wonderful site in Utah. Of course, there's lots of other national monuments, national parks in that region that are really worth visiting. The idea that any of them are shrinking in size and land that had been set aside for public enjoyment and preservation is being turned away horrifies me. So I want to recommend visiting national parks in Utah. But I also want to recommend for people on this side of the Atlantic related to that, the home of John Muir. John Muir, of course, is one of the sort of founders of the environmental movement in the United States, one of the people who pushed for the creation of the what's now the National Park Service at the end of the 19th and early part of the 20th century. But he's from Scotland, and he's from a small town called Dunbar.
Which is beautiful.
We went in November, which is probably not the time to visit Dunbar. Supposedly it was a beach resort town back in the day before people used to go to Spain. But it's a very nice little town, and they have his house where he grew up converted into a museum. It's a very nice, small, free museum in Dunbar, and it's, you know, a 20-minute train ride from Edinburgh. And there's a wonderful walk along the John Muir Way, which starts there along the beach that's along the cliffside, that's really worth a trip. So I highly recommend that to people who are in the region.
Excellent. All right, David. Cheers.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is professor of American history and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at Whiskey Rebel Pod and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.